Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, July 8th, 2002. Today's session is titled How to Respond to Religious Nationalism and Conflict Resulting from the 9/11 Tragedy. This session is entitled Religious Nationalism and Social Polarization and is hosted by Joe Bach. This is session BOJ 2002-1. Let's listen in.
And I guess I'm supposed to ask the people doing the taping to go ahead and start the tape. My name is Joe Bach, and I'm here to work with you this week on how to respond to religious nationalism, particularly that resulting from the 9/11 tragedy. And I'm happy to be here with you. We have five different sessions throughout the week. You're certainly welcome to attend all of them. And what I will be working with everybody on throughout the week will kind of build as the week goes along, so it is cumulative. I should mention that, and I don't think that the bookstore ordered this, but my book is called Sharpening Conflict Management, and you're welcome to order that. It was published in 2001 by Prager. And I should mention that my father, who is now retired but was a barber, has a gift of one-liners. And one of his one-liners was that he felt like the book that I wrote on the basis of my dissertation, he told me that I don't think, Joe, that that's going to be actually displayed at airport newsstands. And I have to say that his endorsement of this is that it's better than my first one. So. Now, I'm not trying to suggest that you need to buy it or anything. Please understand, but it does track a lot of what I'll be presenting this week. What we need to do today is cover three things. First of all, I want to go over some terminology, and in the course of that, I want to hear some of your experiences that perhaps you've encountered while you've suffered the events of 9/11 and your community has suffered the events of 9/11. I want to try to answer a question about, does bigoted religious nationalism raise its ugly head? How does that happen? And the third is, I'd like to cover, if we have time, something called the theory of moral violation, which has been developed by a social psychologist at University of Pennsylvania. So let's start out with some terminology. First of all, what do we mean when we say bigotry? I was talking actually the other day with Michael and Susan Thomas, and Susan's sister Judy said, you know, it's a little bit like a garage sale. When you go to a garage sale, one person's junk is another person's treasure. Well, to some people, something is bigoted, and to others, it isn't. And so I would offer this, that bigotry is thinking that our group is better than another group and being mean about it. Yeah. Does anybody else have another definition that they would like to offer, or another way of explaining it? And in addition, do any of you have any experience with bigotry, particularly regarding our religious group versus other religious groups since 9/11? I think that we've observed two phenomena that that have resulted from 9/11. And one is very healthy, and your attendance is indicative of that tendency, and that is that I think people have become much more concerned and focused on how to build an appreciation of diversity in our society. I would say that that's the overwhelming trend. On the other hand, in a more specific, a more constrained way, I think we have seen increased bigotry, particularly towards Muslims. I think we've seen a tendency for violent incidents, particularly against Muslims. And I think that has challenged the larger community to figure out how to deal with that sort of bigotry that has manifested itself. And so that's really what we're trying to focus on over the next 5 days. Well, if that's bigotry, what is religious nationalism? And how does nationalism differ from patriotism? Anybody have a thought as to what is religious nationalism? What do we mean by when you hear people talk about somebody as being nationalistic? Yes.
Isn't that my country, right or wrong?
My country, right or wrong, America, love it or leave it. To some extent, that is nationalistic. As compared to, it's the 4th of July, I want to put my flag out today. I want to watch a fireworks display. That's patriotism, right? It isn't we're the greatest and everybody else is, you know, below us. That would be more of nationalism. Well, there is a, you know, I know that many people have observed that some of our politicians use religion within the context of patriotism. And people are concerned that when religion is used within the context of patriotism, that religion can become quickly nationalistic, whether those public officials wanted people to start becoming nationalistic with their religion or not.
Could you say that again?
Yes. Public officials sometimes invoke religious imagery and religious symbolism, and they don't necessarily want that to result in religious nationalism, which has an exclusive strand to it and can sometimes be very ugly. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes those religious leaders use those religious symbols or refer to certain religious references for the sake of increasing the emotional potency, say, of a speech. But it doesn't mean that they necessarily want to cultivate religious nationalism in the sense of, you know, we Christians, we American Christians are better than, you know, whatever. You understand what I mean?
Yes, and when I think of nationalism, I think of an adversarial.
Right.
But then when I hear public officials invoking God Bless America,
right,
it does feel very much like to take an opposing view or a dissenting view would be unpatriotic.
Yeah. Right.
And that's what I worry about. God Bless America everywhere you go.
Right.
And I don't know, it's almost like it's empty.
Right.
To me, I mean, I don't know what people mean by it anymore.
Right. I think that there's a lot of concern about that, I think what we'll be getting to later on this week is something that I think some Indian scholars have dealt with quite a bit, because they've had very acute religious nationalism, political parties that are drawn along religious lines, that have their violent thug-related, not-so-distant cousins in the political sphere. So some of the Indian scholars, I think, have a great deal to offer us in terms of how to deal with the linkage between religion and patriotism, and then specifically getting into the more, you know, exclusive brand of religious nationalism. What I will offer here is that religious nationalism is thinking that our religion is better than other religions to the point of exclusivity. It doesn't necessarily mean that it results in the formation of a religiously nationalistic variant of the Ku Klux Klan. It may in fact be more of a way of thinking whereby certain groups in a society end up forming groups that use violence to get their point across. Now there's a final area that I want to cover today that is different than what many of you have probably studied about before when talking about issues of justice and injustice, striving for justice, and how to go about that. In the discussion about that, in the literature on that, there's something called the third way. What do you know about the third way? Can anybody define that? Now you've got to help me today because I was told I can't lecture all the time. So your job is to help participate. The third way, yes.
My sense is not responding to violence with violence.
Okay, not
trying to respond in another way.
That's right, in the third way. So it's rather than being violent in responding to injustice or violence, the third way would be what? What would be an example of using the third way?
Martin Luther King, civil disobedience.
Right, so using civil disobedience. So Martin Luther King decided not to be passive relative to the injustice, but he also decided not to be violent about it. The same way Mahatma Gandhi did. Not saying, it's an interesting part of Gandhi's philosophy that he used to say something to the effect of, I don't really want cowards to be a part of my movement. I want people who are prepared to go out and die to be a part of my movement. The third way is a movement that requires the same degree of commitment as being willing to go out and stand on a battlefield, and in fact it is a battlefield. If you've seen the movie Gandhi where they're walking up in line to get beaten by the soldiers, it was a battlefield. But the third way refuses to kill. It is willing to die. And it is also unwilling to be passive. Now, in the literature on the third way, there's something that I think is lacking that I think is different than the third way. And I call this something called stepping up. And I'm going to explain this to you. It's something that relates to what we'll be doing all week. So this differs from the third way. Stepping up is, and let me offer you an example, and I have to admit that most of my examples are going to be international in nature, and your job is to help keep this relevant to the context of the United States. So if you can bring up examples from the United States or maybe from somewhere else, that's fine, but I'm going to need your help in making sure that a lot of this is related to the United States. Let me give you an example of Rwanda. We all know about the genocide that occurred there. Okay? When a moderate Hutu saw a mob of machete-wielding, violent-prone Hutus approaching the home of a Tutsi family, and at that time, they stood up, the moderate Hutu, or he or she stood up to protect that Tutsi family. They were stepping up. it is not a premeditated thing. Like, if you saw people, you know, in the movie on Gandhi preparing to go essentially to the battlefield and get beaten. That's a premeditated thing. Stepping up is not usually premeditated. It happens on the spur of the moment. And you have to make a very quick decision, are you going to stand up for innocent victims or not? That's the question we're addressing this week. Are you willing to stand up against bigotry when some Muslims in your community are being treated like dirt? Or when their sense of the sacred is being violated? Or when they're being physically threatened? And the best example I can think of, I don't know that it's a premeditated thing, but I do think there's something otherworldly about the ability to do that. Because believe me, the normal human tendency would be to run because you're afraid. And I just want to share with you something, a quote from somebody in Jerusalem. And his name is Jamie, and I'm not going to pronounce his last name correctly, I know. Baumeister? Okay. He's a member of something called the Christian Peacemaker Team in Hebron. It's a group that was formed. Some of you may be very familiar with the Christian Peacemaker Team. It's called CPT is the abbreviation. And it was formed by the Anabaptist churches, Church of the Brethren, Mennonites, and Quakers. But they have people of all different faiths participating. Jamie was out at a Palestinian site one day, and they found out that there was going to be a bulldozer ruining a cistern of a Palestinian family. And on the spur of the moment, now he was standing up to aggression, and that's something I want to emphasize. We're not only trying to stand up against violence, we're trying to stand up against aggression. And on the spur of the moment, before that bulldozer started out, he laid down in front of it. And this is what he said. He said something in front of the international school, the Anglican school in Jerusalem, that really captured the imagination of the students there. And I heard about it later. He talked about something called an eggshell. And so I had heard about this, and I saw Jamie the next day at a reception at the Tantur Ecumenical Institute on the border between Jerusalem and Bethlehem. And I went up to Jamie and I said, Jamie, I want to hear about this eggshell thing. I mean, I'm not understanding this. And this is what he told me. And these are notes from the napkin I was using at Tantur. It was like an eggshell was around me. I was in complete control. It wasn't a physical thing because the soldiers, those who were handling the destruction of the cistern with the bulldozer, they grabbed me. Some people saw that. Some people say that in situations like this, things slow down. But that didn't happen to me. I was in real time. The eggshell was a sense of freedom. The sense that I didn't have to play by their rules. That I could live and act in such a way as to create the type of situation I wanted to create. I had a space where I was free. It was something different than they had. Now that last sentence is important because I think it may convey that he fully understood that maybe some of those Israeli soldiers didn't want to be ruining that system. They may not have agreed with that policy either. But he was totally free to be an instrument of the Holy Spirit. And in that sense, he was stepping up. And stepping up, and this may, I have to admit here and tell you a little bit about my background. I'm not a theologian, and there are those of you in here that have much more training in theology than I do. And if you want to chime in here, you know, please do, because I'm going to get into something now that is theological, and it's why I call it stepping up. And it goes to something that I read in a book by Houston Smith called Forgotten Truth. Houston Smith is a theologian of comparative religions. Grew up as a child of missionary parents. And his book, Forgotten Truth, is trying to distill what the different religions have in common that he considers morsels of truth in understanding the divine. And he found commonality among all the great religions in understanding earthly existence in comparison to heavenly existence. And he identified four planes of reality. And these planes are the terrestrial, the intermediate, the celestial, and the infinite. Now, Sandra Olwine, a good friend of the Thomases I know and a good friend of mine, a Methodist minister with whom I worked in Jerusalem, used to love, one of the great advantages of living in Jerusalem is you can buy pretty much any kind of American food that you want to. And we used to go and buy pecan sandies. Those cookies, I don't know if you've ever had those shortbread pecan sandies. And I distinctly remember standing in the office where I used to work in Jerusalem in Catholic Relief Services with Sandra, eating pecan sandies and discussing the four planes of reality. Sandra, being a trained theologian, said that, you know, there are different ways of looking at these different planes of reality, but that this was okay because nobody really has a perfect understanding of them. But I want to share with you what Houston Smith wrote about these planes of reality. And I'm quoting substantially from his book, Forgotten Truth. And the reason I'm going to quote him is because he says it much better than I do, or much better than I can. And I want to get it right for you. People are able to experience all four planes in the fullness of their being, but the terrestrial plane is the one with which we are most in touch. The intermediate plane governs the terrestrial plane. It possesses both evil and goodness and is the middle area, what Buddhists call the world intermediary, between the natural world and the spiritual world. Sufis, that is saintly Muslims, call it God's footstool, the place where rigor and mercy, God's two feet, reside. In contrast, the celestial plane is God's throne. That plane is beatific throughout, for on God's throne, God sits complete. On elaborating on the celestial plane, Smith notes that it is a conscious whole where awareness intensifies and integration increases. The subtle state coalesces in its totality in the universal total soul. The world mind or world soul is the supreme expression of the divine in the manifest world, but it is far from God's totality. The infinite plane is where the boundaries between terrestrial, intermediate, and celestial are erased, where God's ultimate nature, the infinite, is present. It is unbounded because a boundary would limit it and contradict its infinity. So, I think that something happens that is very unique when people exhibit the kind of courage that Jamie exhibited, or when the moderate Hutus stood up for the Tutsi families, and many of them did, and many of them died in Rwanda. There's something incredible about that. Is it courage? Is it that they somehow encounter some otherworldly experience that is where they just completely, all of their fear evaporates, and somehow they feel this internal peace? I don't know the answer to that, but I can tell you this, that in standing up to bigotry and in being effective as a leader in your community, I think that it does require the power of the Holy Spirit. And the way that I like to understand it is that I think the course of normal human events, we're in here, and somehow religious leaders, it doesn't necessarily have to be somebody with a Master's of Divinity diploma on their wall, somebody who's been ordained. It tends oftentimes to be those people because they've devoted their life to it, but it doesn't require that. You know, there are many people that we know who are religious leaders who aren't necessarily pastors or priests or rabbis or muftis. Those people that are effective, in my opinion, have to somehow move up, step up to the celestial plane. They have to access it somehow. It's a little bit like, and maybe you've studied this in ancient history, the ancient history of Israel, when somebody was pursued by somebody else who was going to kill them. They could seek sanctuary by going to the altar in the temple and grabbing the horn. And I've seen some of these horns at the, what was it called? Jack Lindblom showed us some of these old temples from synagogues, or old altars from temples in Jerusalem. And there literally were horns on the side. And it was a part of the way that people operated there, that if you made it and you held on to that horn, you were safe. And so, in a sense, the challenge is to how to help people. And it seems like there's something that happens in some situations where people have a tendency to gravitate towards the negative emotions of anger, fear, hatred, frustration, disgust. When they have leaders who are bigoted, nationalistic, perhaps in a religious sense, there is a tendency for people to go in that direction. Psychologists call this negativity dominance. There is a tendency for them to go in that direction, and who is the leader that's going to pull them the other way and grab the horn of the altar and say, we are not going to allow these bigots to pull us in the direction of aggression, of smallness, or of violence. That's really our challenge. Now, does our second question, our second area to go to today, before I go on, does anybody have any questions about what I just mentioned?
Yeah, clarify. I mean, are you saying stepping up is better than the third way? Or are you kind of, I mean, just a comment from you about comparing the third way to stepping up.
Okay. No, I'm not saying that either. Both of them are very valuable, but okay. they're different. I'm just trying to point out that there's a difference. The third way is standing up to injustice nonviolently. Mm-hmm. And not being passive about the injustice. Whereas stepping up, and the third way is usually done when there is a group of people who have discerned the truth, and out of their faith commitment, or out of their political commitment, they decide that they're going to stand up to injustice. You know, Mahatma Gandhi, Martin Luther King, those are great examples. And it's premeditated. Before they go out onto the battlefield, quote unquote, they have thought it through, they've prayed about it, they've formed a bond, etc. Whereas stepping up is often something that happens in a very kind of think on your feet type of mode. And I really can't say, but I'm not sure that it has required the degree of use of the spiritual disciplines that are often associated with the third way, where you prepare yourself, you fast. I mean, like the Christian Peacemaker team, you know, they exercise the spiritual disciplines to make decisions. They use fellowship, they do fasting, they do spiritual discernment to make decisions. I mean, that type of thing is involved in the third way. Stepping up, I think, is more of a, it happens, you get faced with aggression, and then you decide kind of how you're going to deal with that on the spot.
Okay. You're just not setting one over against the other. You're just saying that both are...
They're both valuable.
Valuable ways.
Right. Okay. No, they're valuable. I just think they're distinct enough that they require different terms.
Okay.
Yes.
I think it might be helpful to just think of it the more of the kind of individual courage, perhaps, that is in the stepping up, or that there's a kind of the person feels like there's just nothing else possible to do at that point. They have to enter in. It can happen on a playground. It can happen in any number of situations in your life where you're facing some violence or aggression, and you step in to stop, to intervene. and that takes it. It's a different kind of courage, a different kind of moment that you're not in control of in the same way that the premeditated one is. And I think it's also then, in a sense, it's more of a serendipitous or more, in a sense, more of a Holy Spirit moment that you're relying then on something beside yourself to make the situation change.
Mm-hmm. So you're not necessarily trying to make a political point or statement like the third way would be doing. It may be a byproduct of that, but you're stepping up to do what is right at that moment in that situation.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yes. One in the back and then up here. Yes.
Important to choose your battles wisely. I think you need to distinguish between an individual act of conscious based on wisdom and prayerful consideration as opposed to an impulsive, futile action.
Right, although sometimes the stepping up is, it's just, yeah, it, I mean, maybe it is a matter of of futility, but I think that the Hutus, the moderate Hutus, who stood up for the Tutsis and didn't, you know, just walk away or join the Hutu mob, maybe it was futile, but I think they did, some of the ones that did it did save lives. And it's a question of them being convincing to the oncoming group to as to whether or not they're going to live, and secondly, whether or not the Tutsis are going to live, and thirdly, whether the Hutus are going to become violent towards the Tutsis. So I wouldn't, I mean, it isn't necessarily, maybe it is impulse, but I think to some extent, I think it's a little bit different than impulse. It's definitely, you have to make a decision right then and there, as Susan was saying.
You're implying that the confrontation, an immediate confrontation, is the wise course, and oftentimes a strategic retreat and advance in another direction is better than simply sacrificing yourself for no good purpose.
But what I was thinking when you were saying about if you saw somebody slapping their children, or you saw a man about, you know, arguing with his wife and grabbing her and shaking her in the parking lot somewhere, would you just turn away and walk away, or would you say, is everything okay here, can I help? And it's not necessarily, not all of us are going to be in the line of a tank or an oncoming mob with machetes, but there are those opportunities to step up or just turn away and let them deal with it, and it's not my problem. And I don't think in those cases walking away and coming up with a strategy isn't going to help that child or that woman or whatever. In that moment, you have to make a decision.
Right. It's really at that time. I mean, certainly there are times when you've got to think it through and you've got to be strategic. But there are other times, and I, again, this brings out the point that we have to emphasize throughout these next 5 days. There's a difference between imminent violence and kind of almost low intensity aggression, or even moderate intensity aggression. Was there, yes?
Well, I was sort of, what Tracy was saying, sort of getting at my question, which is, why, I'm not quite sure why the spiritual aspect even has to be part of stepping up. It seems to me that there are a lot of situations that are about right and wrong, which is what you're calling the intermediate phase, where you're called to, this is right, this is wrong, you know, mm-hmm. to step up and deal with it. I'm not sure why a spiritual component is a necessary condition. I can understand that in the act of doing it, sometimes you might feel mm-hmm. that's a part of it, but I'm not sure are you making about how fine a point you're making around that.
Well, that's a good question. I mean, it's a phenomenon that I'm not sure that we understand real well. I'm just acknowledging the fact that I do think that people, as I read about Jamie, it seemed to me that he had a total absence of fear. And to me, that in a lot of these circumstances, the normal human tendency would be fear. And that's why I think that there's something otherworldly that goes on there. And I think it's useful for us to get a better understanding of what that is, you know, and how to access that, in a sense, that spiritual strength that one needs to eliminate one's fear.
And I don't think the absence of fear happens before you step up. I think once you put your foot there to take that step, then you hope. That there will be something bigger than yourself at work with you, because that's what I think makes the fear go away. I don't think you wait for the fear to go away and then step. I think it's in the act that something bigger comes into play. I hope. I would hope that's what you mean.
Yes.
The way I'm trying to understand this is
I think I got it from third. The stepping up, if I frame it in terms of instinct, and I think most of us were brought up fight or flight, you know, when we see danger, we see things. And the mob mentality, most like the stepping up, when you talk about the spiritual part of it, it's almost like, it almost has to be trained within us to develop a different way of thinking when we see the mob, or when we see the playground bullying. And that has to do with family upbringing, but also perhaps spirituality, or an ethic, if you will, that we respond instinctually then. Otherwise, our human nature, or in biblical sense, our evil nature, would take over and join in with the hoo-hoo.
Right.
So really, that kind of thing. And so I think if instinctively we see what's right, if we stop and strategize, we may join in with the violence, but that doesn't accomplish anything either. So it's a matter of upbringing, I guess.
Well, it may be upbringing, but it may be something that requires, you know, almost that we have a real diligence about our inner states of being so that we're able to do just as you said. And that's the real struggle here, I think, in the sense, and this is why I've used this imagery, and I made a presentation recently at Eastern Mennonite University, and they weren't real excited about my use of the sword imagery. No, they were just joking with me. But actually, what I've used is that people talk about a double-edged sword, and on the one hand, on the side of what we've called negativity dominance, you've got what emotions? You've got anger, hatred, insecurity, fear, frustration. Okay? You've got all those on the side of a very sharp, very powerful sword that are at the disposal of anybody who wants to conjure up bigotry, religious nationalism, whatever. They're there, they're very potent. On the other side, what do you have? Where's the potency?
Love.
Okay, love. What else?
Altruism.
Altruism.
Acceptance.
Acceptance. Hope.
Patience.
Eternal value?
Mm-hmm. Things that go beyond what you
good
and what lasts in this
world.
Okay. Loyalty.
Loyalty.
Wisdom.
Wisdom.
How about spiritual strength?
Spiritual strength? This is good. I'm glad this is being taped because I sure didn't think of all of these. These are great. Any more?
But they don't sound as powerful as the other side.
Yeah.
Yeah, they don't whip up the passion of the other side.
Exactly.
I mean, but the other side with the patience is not a little passionate. Motivator.
Well, but that's...
But it's a good thing on the
right.
It's not the passion of the other side.
Is it an active word or a passive word?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yes.
I guess I'm referring to this in a more biblical sense, but I, when one gentleman was concerned maybe about the spiritual aspect of the stepping up, I see the majority of it being spiritual in the sense of the Holy Spirit, in that the Holy Spirit has put that decision there, and your choice is, do I act on that or not? And then in conjunction with that, the positive sides of these things that you're talking about could be the fruits of the Spirit, the peace, the joy, self-control, patience, all those things that come with the Holy Spirit are what's acting on the positive behalf of that.
Right, right. Well,
I think that's definitely one way to look at it. That, I guess that's the way I was looking at it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there was one mentioned here called you mentioned loyalty, right? I mean, there are some that aren't necessarily spiritual. They may be psychological, social, psychological. One that I've looked at in terms of the literature is authority and complying to authority. I looked into you may be familiar with the Milgram experiments that occurred and the subsequent research on that. There's some really interesting research from a Princeton University social psychologist named John Darley. And so there are certain things in terms of compliance to authority in a positive direction, equaling compliance to authority in a negative direction. But generally speaking, my feeling is, and I don't know, it sounds like everybody here feels pretty much the same way, the potency is on the side of the negative emotions, kind of consistent with psychological research and negativity dominance. On the other side, you've got positive, more of the positive attributes, states of being that one can cultivate, maybe deliberately over time, as a faith community or as a civil society, certain positive, giving the other the benefit of the doubt, standing up for the absent, those sorts of things. And I feel like what you've got is an asymmetry, and that's why I would say, particularly at certain flashpoints, and the research that I've done, particularly in India, is that at certain times and at certain places, particularly holy days where there's a religious festival and situations like that, you have a potential for a flashpoint because religious passion is high and you've got negativity dominance that can be exploited by those who want to cultivate hatred or violence or bigotry. And on the other hand, you've got the sharp sword on the one side and you've got the butter knife on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
It's not symmetrical. And the reason I got so really concerned about this, or really, it's one of those burning questions inside. I was in a slum in India with a Jesuit priest who had worked for years trying to cultivate interfaith harmony between Muslims and Hindus, and we were standing in the very slum where they started killing each other during a riot. The people that they had cultivated for years, deliberately, to appreciate interfaith harmony, where they had formed peace committees. And during a flashpoint symmetry, or a flashpoint situation, a religious issue came up, and they started killing each other. And to me, and this is why, I mean, I felt so devastated by it, and maybe this imagery isn't good, but for me, it was like the devil had beaten God. And I just couldn't accept that. You know, it was like, here, all this goodness, all this hard work, diligent work that they had done for years, went down the drain in a matter of a couple of days. You talk about negativity dominance. Here was this Jesuit priest devastated by this. Where did we go wrong?
I have a question.
Yes.
I took a class a couple of quarters ago on the theme was on the victims of human rights abuse, and much of the theme was around torture. How common it is, amazingly enough, it's very much of a common practice amongst many, almost all nations. And and the question I had was around how could this be institutionalized and so common? How could there be such a plentiful supply of torturers? And the very common fact is most of them can go home, have nice families, and live nice lives, and they have this job they go to. And it was all around what you talked about, the psychology of authority.
right.
in which the authority says to a person, we have a tough job and we need you. We think you are a person that's up to this and can do this. And they become someone who goes to work and performs the torture. And this isn't a flashpoint. This is
right.
this is institutionalized. It's a part of a bureaucracy. It's right. organized. And
that's really
really the message was is that there's quite a number of people, probably horrifyingly enough, maybe I could be one of these people. Any number of people in this room, if they could be convinced that this was an important aspect of protection of the society, well, et cetera, are capable of this.
Well,
I just wanted to.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I've seen some of the research reports on torture and compliance related to the Milgram experiments. More recently, it's been applied to Greek behavior in Cyprus and police officers. There are some in-depth interviews and that sort of thing. But I agree with you. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's a flashpoint. What I'm talking about in terms of a flashpoint is this. Let me just be real. This kind of lays out. I mean, it helps me to think in a way that you've got some leaders who are violence or on the exploiting the negativity dominance, and I just call those violence promoting leaders. And then on the other hand, I call the other people violence preventing leaders. Okay, so let's just use that. Both of them have followers. Okay, let's just say this. In the case of torture in Cyprus or some place like that, you've got the police officers who have agreed to become torturers. So those are followers. So on the other hand, you've got the violence preventing leaders. And they too sometimes have followers. Let's say, somebody decides that they're going to start standing up to religious nationalism, and different people are going to be involved in that, and they have a tight group of people, or maybe they're cultivating certain spiritual discipline, certain mental ways of looking at things to give people the power on the butter knife side of the last point asymmetry problem equation. Okay, in the middle you've got potential followers, and it's really the question of which way the potential followers are going to go. And then what happens to the victims once these build certain critical mass to affect the victims? And what I'm focusing on to a very large extent is the question here of violence preventing leaders influencing mainly the potential followers as well as leading other followers. In a flashpoint situation where you've got, I think many of you have probably read some of the writings of Walter Wink. He's written about, the soccer riots and how afterwards people at the end of those riots can't believe that they were involved in them. That they did what they did. And so they were potential followers that were captured in this direction. What I'm trying to get at is how can we be real focused on this and cultivate people going in the others. How can we, as spiritual, as believers, cultivate, and I do think that much of it is spiritual, and I do think it's a matter of tapping into the power of the Holy Spirit. Yes.
A liturgy would be helpful in that painful situation in India that you described, and the priest asked, where did I go wrong? How would I answer that question? He had cultivated a peaceful community, and then what was missing?
Well, as far as I can tell, and your question is exactly the question that I kept asking, and it's the one that I hope we can get at more this week. As far as I can tell, he focused the overwhelming amount of his effort on what he and his staff members called promotive programs, to promote interfaith harmony as distinct from preemptive approaches. They distinguish their activities between those two. Now they had regular, you know, relief and development kinds of projects that they did, but they, because of the problem of interfaith violence in India, particularly in Ahmedabad, the state of Gujarat, where they've had this horrendous problem recently, they started using promotive tactics where they would have, for instance, an essay contest to promote the theme of interfaith harmony and that sort of thing. They would have joint sports events. They had a sports committee. They would have a festival every year on the theme of interfaith harmony. They commissioned a song that would be used throughout the city that the newspaper published on interfaith harmony. So all of those were promoted. They did very little preemptive, other than form peace committees that were supposed to go out and counteract rumors. I know we're getting close to being out of time here, but let me just say that what I saw that they did that I really questioned, and I've come to really see this as being the problem with their programming, was that they had an overwhelming amount of focus on promotive and very little focus on setting up preemptive mechanisms within those slum communities where these riots occurred. They set up these peace committees, and they didn't really do a lot of work other than setting them up and you know, responding to these, you know, these vicious rumors, doing that on the spot, that sort of thing. They didn't focus on that near enough. And in one instance, they did call a religious leader of one of the religious communities that was about to attack the other, and that was effective. And so I will get into that later on this week, how working with co-religionists is the way to go, it seems to me. And so I think that we're going to have to stop with that very good question today because we're out of time. I'd be happy to talk with any of you over, I guess we can go to, what's it called, the Ark or the other room? And
Are you thinking you have to stop at 12:15?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm afraid it's only...
Oh, I see.
I think we'll be there now.
I think it's supposed to just go an hour. But I'm happy to have a cup of coffee or some tea over at the dining hall. And if any of you want to talk, I'd love to talk with you. Yes?
How many women are involved in the torture? I mean, performing torture. Do you know?
You know, I didn't get a gender breakdown on the torture part of it that relates to the earlier question. I did get, in terms of the propagating the violence in the slums of India and other places, women are heavily involved.
Are they?
Not so much doing the violence, but in terms of cultivating it.
Yeah, in terms of torture, you have medical staffs. A nurse and a doctor in attendance to determine if the person is close to death so the torture can be ended, so that they it can be resolved later.
In future talk, would you comment on what the Milgram experiments were?
Okay, I'd be happy to do that, sure.
And
yes.
Just in terms of the scope, you're really going to focus primarily on prevention and management, not reconciliation.
Right. I mean, the whole...
It really is important for people to know that there's
right.
a whole other
right.
approach to this stuff that's about going beyond just,
right.
you know, okay.
Well, there are
managing of the conflict.
Right. I mean, there are stages of violence, and certainly there's a lot of reconciliation needed here in this country now. But I think what I'm focusing on is at the earlier stage,
right.
you know, pre-violence.
Right. Good.
That's right. Good distinction.
I'd be interested in knowing if anyone here knows anything about what we're doing with the people in Guantanamo Bay, because other countries have come and tried to get their people out of there, and we aren't letting them go. And the point of putting them there, as far as I knew, was to get information from them about where and what was going on. And in Afghanistan, and I'm really curious about what's going on down there right now with us.
Mm-hmm. It's a good question.
I have a sneaking hunch I know, and I didn't want to. But if anybody does know, I'd like to know.
Yes.
Your story about the futility of the work in India to reconcile the two religious communities reminds me of that scene in West Side Story. Remember the social director
yeah.
trying to get the gangs to interact?
Yeah.
There's something in futility in some of that. Well, I guess we need to look at the pragmatism here. What works?
Right. Yeah, that's really the fifth day. That's what I hope to get. To get. So that's a good commercial for sticking this out. Okay, well, thank you all very much.